Hi, you're with Truth News Radio Australia on the 26th of September 2015. My name's Harold Fenton. Great pleasure to be with you today. Well, today I want to talk about something that's a story that popped up just yesterday. And every now and then something appears in the news that somehow interconnects and clarifies a problem that's been gnawing at you and niggling at you for a long time. And suddenly, you know, an event occurs which connects all the dots, and you realize how stupid you were not to have automatically understood the problem from the beginning. And that's why I love doing this show, because doing this show actually prompts me to make new connections and understand what's really important about life, and not be deluded, you know, not be dragged in to false arguments and false paradigms. Now, the event that I'm talking about that's triggered this little connection in my mind is a story that's been published on a lot of news publications over the last couple of days, and it's about the hacking of fingerprints, a vast number of fingerprints, including the data of around about 20 million people who work for the US government. Now, the data was hacked from an organization called OPM. Now, I'm just going to read to you from Wired magazine. OPM now admits 5.6 million Fed's fingerprints were stolen by hackers. When hackers steal your password, you change it. When hackers steal your fingerprints, they've got an unchangeable credential that lets them spoof your identity for life. When they steal 5.6 million of those irrevocable biometric identifiers from US federal employees, many with secret clearances, well, that's very bad. On Wednesday, the Office of Personnel Management admitted that the number of federal employees' fingerprints compromised in the massive breach of its servers revealed over the summer has grown from 1.1 million to 5.6 million. OPM, which serves as a sort of human resources department for the federal government, didn't respond to Wired's request for comment on who exactly those fingerprints belong to within the federal government. But OPM had previously confirmed that the data of 21.5 million federal employees was potentially compromised by the hack, which likely originated in China, and that those victims included intelligence and military employees with security clearances. The revelation comes at a particularly ironic time during the US visit of Chinese President Xi Jinping, who said at a public appearance in Seattle that the Chinese government doesn't condone hacking of US targets. Now, there's a few things I need to draw together in discussing this. One is the problem with biometrics in itself, the intrinsic problem with using biometrics as a security measure. Now, we all know with passwords that a password needs to be changed frequently in order to maintain the highest level of security. No matter how good your password is, you should change it every few months. Recommendations vary, you know. Some say every couple of months, some say every 6 months. But, you know, you need to change it frequently. And, of course, a biometric identifier is really nothing more than a password. It's just an encoded set of data which is unique, which identifies one individual. So a password and a set of biometric data are not really that different. Once it gets down to the point of authorization, the authorization is either performed against the password or it's performed against biometric data. Of course, the difference is that biometric data is much more complex. It would be the equivalent to a much, much longer password, probably a longer password than anyone could possibly remember. So in that sense, and for that reason, it has been proposed that biometric security is safer because it would be harder to crack a biometric encoded authorization token than it would be to crack a password. But we have to distinguish between hack and crack, because although it may be easier to, although it may be difficult to crack a biometrically stored authorization token, it may not be that hard to hack it, you see. And it may even be easier, and this is the ultimate irony, it may even be easier to hack a biometrically stored piece of data than it would be to crack it or to crack a password. And there's a number of examples which I'll bring to you in this show today that demonstrate just that it is actually frighteningly easy, especially with fingerprints, to hack fingerprint data. And there was one example that I read where it was done simply by taking a photograph, a high-resolution photograph, of the individual from a distance with the hands exposed, and they were able to get a detailed image of the fingerprints of that person from the photograph. Now, when you read about what the trends in biometrics and what people are saying and what conferences are saying, conference organizers and experts who come to talk about it, you'll find there's a rather bizarre split. Every time you read an article about biometrics, you'll have the main thrust, and this actually typically comes from government itself, comes from high-level government officials, saying, oh, biometrics, 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 it's the only solution. It's the only thing that'll protect us. We must move away from passwords. Let's get rid of passwords forever and only have biometrics. But then you get the experts coming in and saying, well, wait a minute. And every time, and I've read quite a number of articles on this now, every time you have some high-level government official or some PR spokesman saying how great biometrics is, there's another expert who comes forward and says actually the opposite. And for the very reason that that I led this story with, that whereas passwords can be changed, biometric data is forever. And so once your biometric data has been compromised and you are tied in to a biometric identification system, you're in big trouble. And it's very hard to see how you're going to get out of that trouble. Especially as more and more organizations go down the biometric route, if your biometric data is compromised, your future is not looking that great. It's almost like, you know, being diagnosed with a terminal illness. Because that data is irrevocable, it's permanent, it's attached to you forever. And you never know if 10 years down the line or something, or 20 years down the line, it may be used against you. Yeah, it's like being diagnosed with AIDS or something. At some point in the future, if your data is compromised, something bad could happen to you. Now, that's one aspect of it, right? The aspect of the inherent insecurity of biometric data. And this applies to all biometric data, folks. It's not just fingerprints. It applies to any biometric data that is irrevocable and is tied to you as a person. The other side to the problem is we have these vast organizations, like this government one in the United States, who are collecting all this data and storing it on their cloud servers. And of course, there are many other companies doing the same thing. There are many, many, many companies now that use biometric identification for their employees. And increasingly, there are warehousing companies that store that data. And it's all in one place, you know, millions of records of information. So once one of those companies that stores that information is hacked, all of that information is compromised. I mean, does that really sound like an increased level of security to you? Or does it sound like the opposite? Does it sound like it's a setup for people to basically have no security whatsoever? Because once powerful organizations and powerful crime organizations, intelligence organizations, all the different groups that are out there that have a lot of money and resources and are able to do this kind of hacking, well, once they can get hold of your personal information, you're going to lose a lot of your freedom. You really are. Like we project this, we extrapolate this into the future. We're only at the early phase of this now. We extrapolate this into the future, 10, 20, 30 years. Compromises are inevitable. Hacks are inevitable, ladies and gentlemen. So it really is a story of great concern. Now, I've just got a few articles here to read to you in relation to that. Here's another one from NPR. And this is typical of the coverage of this. Passwords get hacked a lot. In an effort to move beyond passwords, big companies are embracing biometric technology. To heighten security, smartphones are being outfitted with biometric features. At a big security conference called RSA, thousands of people gather in San Francisco's Moscone Center, selling products to make life online more secure. Connor White, an executive at a biometrics company called Dayon, begins to demonstrate how he logs into his bank account. "I've just launched our mobile app, and you can see here I'm straight into the app," he says. "Watch how it authenticates me." He doesn't type in a password, he just holds his iPhone up to his face like he's going to take a selfie. And if self-security doesn't work, say you're in a dark room, you can use your fingerprint instead, or your voice. His company recently landed a big contract with USAA to do biometric identification for the financial services firm's account holders. And there is a race to patent going on with these various organizations. But now in the same article, towards the end, it says here David Cohen with Bessemer Venture Partners is an investor, but he refuses to invest in biometrics. We are going to break. I'll be right back. Stay with us. Interesting show today. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm just reading to you some articles here in regard to biometrics and the true risk-benefit equation in relation to biometrics. And it's not looking too good, folks. Now, just reading here, there was an article on npr.org, and there was a conference, and they were saying how wonderful biometrics is. And then it said here one of the investors had put over $100 million into digital security companies but refuses to invest in biometrics. "Either a password or a biometric can be stolen," he said, "but only a password can be changed. Once your fingerprint is stolen, it's stolen forever and you're stuck. Hackers have already made dummy fingerprints using pictures of people's hands available online to swipe into the iPhone 6 scanner. I've got another article here from phys.org. As hacking grows, biometric security gains momentum. Biometrics, which can include fingerprints, iris scans, facial or voice recognition, got a major boost with Apple's introduction of its iPhones with Touch ID. Samsung followed with its own fingerprint scanner. Major tech firms, Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, are saying the consensus is growing that the simple password needs to be replaced. Kill the password dead. I would love to kill the password dead as a primary security method because it's terrible, White House cybersecurity coordinator Michael Daniel told a security firm last year. Tens of millions of passwords have been stolen in breaches of major retailers. If you don't eliminate dependency on the password, you're not solving the problem. He says fingerprint identification made major strides and that other technologies are still being improved. But then, in the same article, again, it says here, but not everyone in the tech world sees biometrics as the solution to security problems. If you have a credit card that gets compromised, you can get a new credit card. But what do you do if your iris or your fingerprints get compromised? Says Sasha Meinrath, head of New America Foundation's X-Lab studying new technologies. Meinrath noted that there have already been successful efforts to fake someone's fingerprint and that other biometrics may also see the same fate. This presents an entire new realm of security problems, he says. Now, it says here, new technologies are helping make biometrics more secure. Stephanie Schucker, a Clarkson University professor, said some research is focused on liveness detection to guard against faking fingerprints or other biometrics. This would ensure that a real biometric is there at that time and place and recognize a fake version of that stolen fingerprint. And of course, there'll be a way of faking that and hacking that as well. For everything you can come up with, there'll be a way of faking it, right? This is the simple fact of the matter, is that everything can be faked and every security system can be compromised. You have to accept that as a fundamental fact. Every piece of data can be duplicated and every security system can be compromised. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean? What is the correct pathway then to real security? It means adaptation. It means changing the password frequently. It means not using the same identifier over and over again, as well as maintaining the best security that you can do, as well as preventing people from being able to copy things. But ultimately, those measures will not prevent a determined and well-resourced hacker or cracker from being able to get into your data. So I want to turn now to consider another aspect of this, and that's why this story is so interesting, because it really draws together so many threads. Because I want to talk about the social implications, the societal implications, and the implications for the freedom of the individual and for privacy of biometric identification. Because here I believe we get to the nub of what biometrics are really all about. And I can draw a parallel here between the misconceptions about biometrics and, you know, its purported goal and function and its real underlying function. I can draw a parallel between that and the debate about torture. I know that may seem like a completely off-the-beam comparison, but I will explain it in detail. But first of all, let me just go into biometrics and let's talk about what the implications are for the individual with biometric identification systems. Now, if you buy a laptop and it's got one of those scanners on it or an iPhone, you know, no big deal. You either use it or you don't use it. It's up to you. Not a big deal, right? There is still the problem of your information being compromised if you do use it, but you can help. You know, you can just say, I'm not going to use it. Not so easy when you're in a company that has decided to use biometric identification instead of the old electronic swipe cards. And I know many, many companies now in Sydney and probably throughout Australia are using fingerprint identification as a replacement to the swipe card. So when you arrive at work, you basically, you know, put your thumbprint on the scanner, and that's how you get into work. Now, there are some inconveniences for the worker in that, although in some ways it's also convenient because you don't have to worry about losing your card. But of course you can't borrow someone else's card. So if you had a problem, if for some reason your account wasn't activated, you wouldn't be able to get in. You can't borrow someone's fingerprint unless you chop their finger off, or, you know, there's a few problems there. So there's some convenience and some inconvenience factors there. Beyond that, there's also the ability now with biometric identification of the controllers, those who sit at the top of the hierarchy, who hold the biometric data of employees or large groups of people, to use that to invade their privacy, to find out what they're up to. I mean, simple example is if you're at work and you have to use your thumb scanner to go in and out, people will know exactly where you've been, how long you've been out for. You can't just, you know, borrow someone else's card. You can't do that anymore. Of course, it's probably possible with card scanners to do that kind of big brother surveillance, but it's even more facilitated with thumb scanners. And of course, you know, that just gives the employer, your boss, the ability to put the screws on you if they're so inclined. Of course, in most cases that won't happen, but it facilitates that. But that's a fairly trivial example. On a much larger scale, when you submit to a biometric identification, for example, if it were used for government services, then you can be monitored. I mean, your movements, everything you do is tied to you specifically as an individual. And so there is an inevitable ability there to invade your privacy and also to deny you access on a very, very focused level to any information or services or whatever it is that the fingerprint is being used for. And I should point out that some countries are using a fingerprint biometrics as the main method by which people are identified when they enter a country. The United States, in fact, uses it. So everyone who enters the United States gets a finger scan. All of that data is going on to centralized servers. I mean, think about the implications of that. It is really quite shocking. The information getting into the wrong hands, and what it means about them knowing about personal details about you that could later be tracked. We're going to break. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm talking today about biometrics and the real story with biometrics. What it's really all about, as opposed to the PR spin that gets you thinking that it's a good idea. So what we see is that the function of biometrics, what biometrics actually does well, as opposed to what it does really badly, like, you know, security. It's really bad in terms of protecting your security. But what it's good at is invading people's privacy and controlling people, right? It's a good tool to be able to have power over people, over large numbers of people. It's actually good at that. It excels at that. And that, my friends, I believe is the real purpose and reason why it is being introduced everywhere all around the world. While it's being sold to you as this wonderful panacea against cybersecurity threats, what it's really to be used for is to track, trace, monitor, control, and restrict your behavior. And the agencies that are given the power over you to do that are innumerable, and many of them completely unknown, many of them possibly completely criminal. I mean, there are massive mafia networks operating on this planet that can hack into this data too. There's opportunities for extortion. There's opportunities for all kinds of purely criminal behavior as well as tyrannical government behavior that's all made possible by our acceptance of a biometric identification as the solution to cybersecurity threats. Now that brings me back to my point earlier that I made, that this is similar to the argument about torture. Now, torture, or as they call it, enhanced interrogation techniques, were introduced by the United States Armed Forces as part of their war on terror, because they thought it was a good idea, because you have to be able to find the ticking time bomb, you know, and that bad guy there who's sitting in a small room in handcuffs may have that information, but, you know, he's too comfortable and he's not going to tell you unless you put a bit of pressure on him, you know. So stress positions, you know, make him stand up for 24 hours at a stretch, a bit of waterboarding, you know, maybe fake electrocution threats, maybe have dogs come, maybe let the dogs bite him occasionally. Yeah, that's torture, as we know. That is torture. Fits the definition of torture. Now, that's sold to you as a good thing. They said, well, you know, it's unfortunate, but, you know, we've got to do it because we've got to find the ticking time bomb, and this guy, he's got the information, you've got to make him talk, you know. Now, what's the real facts? What's the real facts about torture? The real facts about torture from any people who've been done it in the field, who've got seasoned experience, who are honest, say it is the worst way to try and get information. It is guaranteed to give you rubbish information. Why? Pretty obvious. It's not rocket science. A person who is being tortured will say anything to make the pain stop. Anything at all. What that means is that your information source is completely polluted. You will not have a clue as to what's real, what's made up, and there will be mountains of it, because people who are being tortured tend to gush information, and it will actually impede rather than aid an investigation. This is a fact. This has been proven scientifically. It's not hearsay. It's a simple fact. And these people who implemented these types of systems knew from the beginning that was the case. So isn't that odd? Isn't it odd? Why did this happen? Why did the US State Department, why did the CIA, why did Dick Cheney, why did all these people endorse this turning to the dark side, as they said? What's it really about? Well, it turns out that the study of torture has already shown, and it's already been well researched and well documented, that the main function of torture is, was, and always will be extracting confessions. That is what torture is good for, and boy, is it good for extracting confessions. You know, people will confess to murdering their grandmother. You know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed confessed to dozens of crimes that he could not even physically possibly have committed because he was already in prison when they occurred. But boy, did he write those confessions because he was being tortured. In Cambodia, under the Khmer Rouge, in their famous torture prison S21 in Phnom Penh, the arrested political prisoners were tortured day after day for weeks or months. And they wrote the most incredible confessions. I mean, these people wrote confessions that were just would blow your mind to read. You know, they made things up. Many of them, because they actually hadn't done anything wrong and they hadn't committed any crimes, they had to be incredibly inventive to think of crimes that they might have committed that would seem plausible, but a lot of them were just ridiculous. But that's what happens when people are being tortured. But you see, extracting confessions is a very useful tool for tyrants, for tyrannical governments, because when you round up people you don't like and put them in dungeons, it's very, very helpful from a PR point of view if they make a lot of confessions, because then it actually justifies your having rounded them up. So, to cut a long story short, what I'm saying is that this whole debate over biometrics is very, very similar to the debate over torture, is that there is a PR story given as to what is being done and why it's being done, and there is the real agenda, which just is continuing relentlessly. And it won't stop. It won't stop unless we speak out about it. I mean, you need to put this up on a blog. You need to talk to people about this. You need to lobby your representatives, your government. We need to understand the dire threat to freedom, privacy, and our way of life represented by biometric authorization systems. And what amazes me is, you know, I didn't quite connect all the dots about this for many years, because when they run the argument on you, when they run the PR argument about the safety issue, you tend to go, yeah, wow. I mean, it's like, you know, these iris recognition and various other recognition systems do have a high level of accuracy, you know, and it's impressive, you know. Facial recognition, you know, can just identify a face in a crowd, and it does look like it would be a fail-safe way for identifying someone. But that's only in the ideal scenario where it's not possible to steal the information. Once it's possible to steal the information, that becomes completely useless. But the ability to identify a face in a crowd remains incredibly valuable to the police. And you can be sure that they use photographic recognition a lot. And they use the photograph on your driver's license as part of a biometric identification system. Every time you are photographed for your driver's license or a passport, that is used, that is actually converted into a biometric data store and is actually used in a variety of ways for biometric identification. This has already been in place in New South Wales and Australia for several years. And it can be used by the police in investigations. So, interesting times we live in. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We're going to break. Stay with us.
in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it? And
at that point, hi, welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. Now, I want to change the subject now. I want to play in the last segment today a short clip from a video of an interview with Freeman Dyson, a renowned physicist. And as I was saying last week, there have been a number of really eminent scientists come forward to question the anthropomorphic climate change alarmist position, which, of course, is still being rammed down our throats by governments and by mass media, and will increase as we lead in to the Paris Climate Change Conference, which seeks to ratify a global treaty on emissions. Now, I'm going to play to you the clip. This guy is really, really awesome, a really amazing man, and he's—I believe he's about 90 years old. So he's been around and he knows a lot, but he's incredibly sharp. So I will just play this for you now, and this will probably take us through to the end of the hour. Here we go. First, it begins with a short introduction on the man.
Today we'll hear from Freeman Dyson. He's a 91-year-old mathematical physicist, one of the most renowned scientists in the United States, been around for six decades.
He had an extraordinary mind. Talking to one of our previous guests who went, you're talking to who? Like, to say that he has a big brain would be an understatement.
That's right. And this is someone who actually works in the same building at Princeton that Einstein worked in. And interestingly enough, not only works in that building, but he was actually there when Einstein was there.
I know, it's extraordinary. You go into the building, there's this bust of Albert Einstein, and the address is 1 Einstein Drive, and it dawns on you that this is a place where some rather extraordinary thinking happens.
Extraordinary, and in his own words, subversive science.
Contrarian.
Contrarian, yeah. Freeman Dyson believes we ought to be using science as a way to upend the apple cart, and particularly teach young people that science can be an act of rebellion, positive rebellion, you know, to push against
now,
poverty.
There's many people who are on the climate change side of the equation who are advocating that we're in trouble, and they say that science is supports that. They're not going to be so happy with the conversation with Freeman Dyson.
Well, Freeman Dyson is probably someone that comes out on more of the neutral side in terms of climate change. He obviously acknowledges that there's rising carbon in the environment.
And that the temperature has gone up.
The temperature has gone up. But I think his approach is to say we don't know enough. And, you know, we need to focus on things in the world that we know enough about to change.
You're right. Not knowing enough. He says, well, I know the guy who designed the first computer model that all of the models are based on. Like, he knows the guy, and he knows that the model can't mirror what is in climate. And this is his point. And so he says, yes, we've had this effect, but it's the predictive model that is difficult for him to embrace.
That's right. And which is what makes his voice on this issue, particularly as somewhat of a contrarian, even that much more important and pivotal, really, in the entire debate.
Oh, there are people who are not going to be happy with what Mr. Dyson has to say, but it's a conversation that we believe was worth having. Let's go to that now. This time from the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton University, joining me now is Freeman Dyson. Mr. Dyson, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Man-made climate change, where are we at from your perspective? Is it incontrovertible science, or are we being led down a path that you are suspicious of?
Well, first of all, there is man-made climate change. I mean, it's a question how much, and is it good or bad? And there are all sorts of questions. the fact that it exists is not a question. Certainly there is some effect of humans on climate, and we have to try to find out what it is. All I would say is, first of all, we don't understand the details. It's probably much less than is generally claimed. And much of the most important thing is that there are huge non-climate effects of carbon dioxide, which are overwhelmingly favorable, which are not taken into account. To me, that's the main issue, that the Earth is actually growing greener. This has been actually measured from satellites. The whole Earth is growing greener as a result of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So it's increasing agricultural yields, it's increasing the forests, it's increasing all kinds of growth in the biological world. And that's more important and more certain than the effects on climate.
Well, this is where you started your research, isn't it? In the effects of CO2 on vegetation.
Yes.
And over the years, what have you found?
Well, it's increasing just more or less as we expected. I started working on this 37 years ago, and at the time when there were, we thought the effects were maybe about 10%, and now it's probably more like 25% after 35 years. It's essentially what we expected. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has gone up by 40% in that time or something like that.
Yeah, up to about 400 parts per million at the moment. Just shy of that, I think.
Yes, about half of that has gone into raising vegetation. So vegetation has increased on the average by around 20%. And that's observed. And of course, it's extremely important. It actually is enormously beneficial both to food production and also to the biodiversity, preservation of species and everything else that's good. So the remarkable thing is that these effects, which have nothing to do with climate, effects of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, are so much easier to measure than the effects on climate, and so much more certain.
Well, I know that in a greenhouse where there is, industrial growing of plants for food production, the carbon dioxide parts per million is up around 1,200 parts per million. We know that it works in an actual greenhouse, but there was a considerable amount of concern as to whether or not that would actually translate into the atmosphere globally. And you're saying that the evidence is in that the benefit exists in the world at large as well.
Yes, on the average. I mean, of course, it's not true everywhere, and you can find cases where it doesn't work and cases where it does work. If you look at the details, it depends on what other nutrients are available. Of course, if the growth of plants is limited by not having enough nitrogen, then giving it more carbon won't help. And so most of the time there is enough nitrogen, and giving it more carbon does help. So it's understandable that the effects vary from place to place.
You're also on record as saying that we will be able to genetically re-engineer trees to help absorb any excess amount of carbon that's in the environment. And I was reading recently about precision genetic engineering so that we can splice right into the gene and say, this is the particular component. Do you see this being like an alternative if we get to the point where we go, the level of CO2 in the atmosphere is something that we're uncomfortable with?
Yes, but that's in the very long run. And so I think people have to understand there are some things which are true right now, other things which will be true in 100 years, and other things which will be true in 500 years, and that makes a big difference. So what you're talking about, genetic engineering of the plants all over the earth, I would say it probably at least 100 years from now. It certainly will be important in the long run, but it's a very long run. So one shouldn't think of that as something we're going to be doing in the next 10 years.
So if I come back to the question of CO2 in the atmosphere, we've seen about a 40% increase, I believe, over the last 130-some-odd years of measurement. Is that correct?
That's accurate, yes.
But we haven't seen a 40% increase in temperature. So the rise of CO2 doesn't necessarily correlate to temperature change. Do you understand why all of a sudden then there is such concern about CO2 increases and what it's going to do to global temperatures?
Well, I don't try to impute motives to people. I mean, I disagree with people very strongly, but I don't say that they're evil because they disagree with me. So I'm not talking about, I think I don't want to analyze other people's motives. There certainly is an enormous religion in which there are lots of true believers who think that climate change is evil and that we're going to run into big catastrophes if we don't do something drastic. And that's a sort of a belief system which exists. I don't understand it, and I don't pretend to understand their motives.
But so much of that belief is predicated upon models that are represented, computer models that take data from weather stations around the world, and they say that this modeling demonstrates that this projection is going to work.
This, of course, I've always been fighting against, the idea that the models actually are good predictors. And my friend Yuichiro Minabe, he's a Japanese climate expert who lives here in Princeton, and he was actually the first person who ever did climate models with increased carbon dioxide just to see what it would do. And he found the warming, and it was less than is now fashionable, but anyway, there was some warming.
Is this the modeling that goes back to the late 60s?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. A really, really excellent interview, and it's quite a bit longer than that. It goes for about 22 minutes. So I recommend, I'll put that on the website and you can have a look at it. And I will be back next week. It's been great talking to you today, and I hope you've found any insights that I've given to you worthwhile. Please send me an email if you have any thoughts, and I look forward to speaking to you again very soon. Truth News Radio Australia, signing out.